It's Monday, May 12th. I'm Jane Coaston, and this is What A Day, the show that thinks President Donald Trump accepting a luxury plane from the Qatari royal family to serve as the new Air Force One is very normal and cool and not corrupt and definitely doesn't make me think of the Trojan horse, which definitely ended totally fine for the city of Troy. On today's show, White House Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller says the Trump administration is thinking about putting a major constitutional right on pause because that's definitely how rights are supposed to work. And the White House projects confidence after a weekend of trade talks with China. But let's start today with you. Yes, you. It's 2025. And if you were born in or after 1981, making you a millennial, or 1997, making you Gen Z, there's a good chance that you are qualified and prepared to manage other people or run for political office. Yes, even you, the person who shares I'm just a baby memes. Now, maybe you have been thinking about running for office. You see everything that's going on right now and you're thinking, I want to make this better. And sure, you might not be thinking about running for the House or Senate because big races can be very expensive. And besides, spending lots of time in the same vicinity as, say, Georgia Republican Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene sounds like a punishment for a crime you never committed. But city council? School board? State legislature? The positions that, to me, matter most if you want to make real change for everyday people? But even if you don't want to run for office, no matter where you work or what industry you work in, whether you're newly elected to the state senate or leading a team at work, you might have had a sudden realization. You have absolutely no idea what you're doing, or how to do it, or how to look like you know what you're doing. I get it. You want to be a good leader, but you don't want to be an asshole people complain about on Reddit. You want to be effective, but not ruthless. You want to be authentic, but you aren't exactly sure what that means. Just how much about your life should the people you work with know? You have a lot of questions about being a good leader. And honestly, so do I. So I talked to Amanda Littman. She's co-founder and president of Run for Something, and author of the new book, When We're in Charge, The Next Generation's Guide to Leadership, which comes out tomorrow. Amanda, welcome to What A Day.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
So your book aims to be a practical manual for millennials and Gen Zers who are taking on positions of power, but not necessarily exclusive to those who are in political office. What are the common threads you see across industries, no matter where people are working?
So for the book, I interviewed folks from tech, media, I interviewed faith leaders, teachers, doctors, you know, across all different sectors. And I heard a bunch of things in common. One, they felt like they were operating without a playbook. Like they were trying to do things differently than every boss they'd ever had before, which meant they didn't really have a good role model for it. Two, they had been told, be yourself, be authentic. And it's like, what does that look like in practice? Like, what does that actually mean if you're in charge of other people? Three, that it was so lonely. Oh, I heard this in so many of my conversations, that leadership is so lonely.
Right. I just keep thinking about how there's a real tendency for people our age to come in and be like, should we be like the cool mom? Where it's like, no. Those rules are for other people, but we're cool. And then it turns out that actually rules are cool sometimes.
Boundaries are great.
Huge fan. But do you think those hurdles are unique to younger people, or do you think it just looks different now, how we are perceiving what leadership is?
I think a lot of these are challenges leaders of all ages have faced, like over millennia. But I think some of the tactics of the modern era make it really different. Like, you can't have a Zoom meeting without being afraid that it's going to go viral because someone could be recording it or screenshotting it. Like, that wasn't true even 5 or 10 years ago. Similarly, you know, our bosses that we had 5 or 10 years ago didn't have to think about how they posted on Instagram and what their employees might see because there just wasn't like a thing that you had to do. Similarly, like, what does it mean to show up at work with tattoos or a different kind of hair or like wear fun earrings? Like, the changing definition of professionalism has really expanded the models of what you can look like, which I think is a good thing, but also can be really scary.
Absolutely. And one of the points you make that I really want to drill into a little bit more is the importance of bringing your authentic self to a leadership role, but like not yourself self, which you and I think we both know what that means. You talk about it in the book, but what do you mean by your authentic self? And why is that an important quality? But it's also not sometimes what we think it means.
You know, I think that especially like influencers, celebrities, politicians who we feel like are being authentic have taught us what a particular way that looks like. And we don't always like break it down to realize, no, this is a performance. even the people we think are being their true selves, like they're still self-regulating. They're still like choosing silence sometimes. And that doesn't mean they're not being who they are. They're just being intentional. I think a lot of folks sort of get this intuitively once you start to explain it, but your job is not to be your true self. It's to be your best self, especially when your leadership is at work. And that sometimes means moderating to know what your team needs to hear. Because actually, and I think this is the most important thing about all of this, is like your leadership is not about you. It's about your team and about what they need from you. And that sometimes means you have to adjust a little. And that's okay. That's not faking it. That's strategic.
Yeah. And how do you find that line in politics? You've done so much important work through Run for Something. And it feels like voters are really thirsty for authenticity. And I think you're seeing this now where a lot of people in politics have decided that swearing makes you authentic. But there is a degree to which we actually don't want authentic authenticity. So for people who are interested in pursuing politics, how do you make yourself accessible and transparent without oversharing yourself too? Because that's not just off-putting to other people. It's also tough on you.
Yeah, I think the like psychological harm that it can do when you give your full self to your audience, your followers, your community, your constituents, your voters, like it means when they don't like you, which like even the most popular politician hypothetically has like a 70% approval rating, a 60% approval rating, which doesn't even really happen anymore. That still means 30 or 40% of people don't like them. And it can be really hard to take that mentally if you have given everything you have to those people. So, you know, what Run for Something tells our candidates is like, be really clear about what you believe, know what your values are, know sort of what you want your brand to be. Like, what are the personal parts of your life that you want to share with people? You know, maybe it's your sports fandom or your hobbies or like your exercise workouts or your family, whatever it is. And then know what you don't want to share and don't be afraid to hold firm around those boundaries.
Yeah, and I think that we're seeing some pushback to the share everything world by millennials who are exhausted by it because we've been doing it since
we were teenagers.
Oh, I just started thinking about the overwhelmed. And, you know, Gen Zers who may not have just experienced sharing their lives themselves, but even having their parents share their lives. There's so much emotional labor involved in being online and performing online. But I think especially in public-facing jobs like media or politics or business in some cases, you kind of have to be. So for would-be leaders who are worried about how to share, not share, what to share, what not to share, do you have any advice?
I have so much advice. There's a whole chapter just on social media specifically. You know, I think about with like the Gen Zers understood this intuitively of the idea of a Finsta. You have a private Instagram just for your friends because you know there's some parts of you you don't want to give to the world, but you do want to give to the people you are intimate with. And knowing that not everything requires a personal statement. You don't have to like announce your endorsement or announce your stance on everything. That doesn't mean you don't care. That doesn't mean you don't have values, but like really being conscientious that everything you post online is part of a strategic communications tool. Doesn't mean fake. It just means intentional.
And I want to talk a little bit more about politics because you've talked a lot and worked a lot on how Trump's return to office has driven a wave of first-time interest in running for office. It's something that we saw, as you well know, back in 2016, 2017, 2018, which helped lead to a blue wave and to, I would argue, Biden's election in 2020. What are you seeing on the ground this time?
So in the 6 months since Election Day, which last week marked 6 months since Election Day, feels wild, Run for Something has seen more people sign up to run for office than we did in the entire first 3 years of Trump's first term. We've had about 45,000 people raise their hands that join our pipeline, which now numbers over 200,000 young people. It is an unprecedented surge in organic interest that makes me really excited for what is possible in 2026, because I think we've now seen in the last couple special elections, the Wisconsin Supreme Court race, that when we run, we can win. So we got to run and field candidates everywhere because the battlefield could be really, really big.
Now, I know your organization focuses a lot on down ballot races, which I think is fantastic because I think that that can be often some of the most important places for political decision making. But I think one of the barriers that a lot of young people see, and even people like I'm 37 and I'm thinking in politics terms, I'm a child because Congress is dominated by people who are much older than me and much older than Gen Zers, and they may have held their job for decades. And it's really easy to feel overwhelmed by those forces that entrench the status quo of incumbency. So What are you telling people who feel daunted by that?
One, you can do this. So I think it's just like straight up words of encouragement. You can do this. Two, politics is like everything else. That the more you do it, the better you get at it. Nobody is born a politician the same way nobody's born a writer or a musician. You become a politician by putting your name on the ballot. Local races are where most of these politicians got their start. Very few people start right with Congress. And I would argue Congress doesn't seem that fun to begin with. And these local positions, like, you don't need as much money as you think. I think that 75% of school board races cost $1,000 or less. 85% cost $5,000 or less. That's a lot of money, but it's also not the millions you see being talked about with congressional campaigns. Most people, the number of voters you need to talk to is in the thousands. If you're willing to work hard and knock doors, you can absolutely outwork an incumbent, especially, who probably doesn't see you coming.
So how does the next generation force change when those who are in power, for reasons we could get into that, they aren't ready to relinquish it? How do you do it?
You run against them. You force the conversation about the issues in which they're not doing a good job enough. So whether it's not holding town halls, not fighting hard enough, not investing back in community, you go where they aren't. And you go where they are, which feels like sort of contradictory advice. But both being present in the community and the places the incumbent isn't showing up, and then also making sure that they can't escape you, like go to the forums, demand presence, call them out for being afraid of you, and then know that you're going to have to create a little bit of productive conflict and that you can't be afraid of that, especially in a primary challenge where you probably agree on most things. You probably share the values. You've really got to be able to present an alternative vision for what the community could get if you win. I think that's the final piece of really any good campaign, is it's about voters, not about you. That's why do they want you to win, not why do you want to win, which is because winning is great and losing sucks.
Amanda, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me, and I'm glad you appreciated the book.
That was my conversation with Amanda Littman, co-founder and president of Run for Something. Her new book, When We're in Charge, The Next Generation's Guide to Leadership, is out tomorrow. And you can order it now at crooked.com/books or wherever you get your books. We'll also throw a link in our show notes. We'll get to more of the news in a moment, but if you like the show, make sure to subscribe, leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, watch us on YouTube, and share with your friends. More to come after some ads. What a Day is brought to you by bookshop.org. Whether you're searching for an incisive history that helps you make sense of this moment, a novel that sweeps you away, or the perfect gift for a loved one, bookshop.org has you covered. When you purchase from bookshop.org, you're supporting more than 2,000 local, independent bookstores across the country, ensuring they'll continue to foster culture, curiosity, and a love of reading for generations to come. And big news, bookshop.org has launched an ebook app. You can now support local, independent bookstores even when you read digitally. Use code WAD to get 10% off your next order at bookshop.org. That's code WAD at bookshop.org. Here's what else we're following today.
Headlines.
So we do expect a 10% baseline tariff to be in place for the foreseeable future, but don't buy the silly arguments that the U.S. consumer pays. Businesses, their job is to try to sell to the American consumer, and domestically produced products are not going to have that tariff. So the foreigners finally have to compete. They're going to have to compete. What happens is the businesses and the countries primarily eat the tariff.
Sure. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick was quick to defend President Trump's tariffs when asked if the baseline 10% tariff in the framework for the U.S.-UK deal announced last week would stay in place. The secretary spoke with CNN's Dana Bash on Sunday about taxes on imports, inflation, and trade deals. You know, everyone's three favorite things. Just a reminder, consumers seeing an increase in prices is not a silly argument. While companies pay the tariffs, the costs are often passed along because businesses would like to make money, because that's how capitalism works. Most economists say that ultimately consumers, meaning us, everyday Americans, end up paying more. So what about those across-the-board tariffs on the entire world? Well, they're not going anywhere either.
Is that 10% tariff kind of a baseline in the way you're approaching these other countries that you're negotiating with?
Yes, we will not go below 10%. That is just not a place we're going to go.
Lutnick also commented on the U.S.-China trade negotiations, saying things, quote, feel really good, but didn't go into further detail. Although in an interview with Fox News Sunday, Lutnick did acknowledge that the 145% and 125% tariffs the U.S. and China have on each other are, quote, too high to do business.
I'm happy to report that we've made substantial progress between the United States and China in these very important trade talks.
Speaking of China and tariffs, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent appeared confident after a weekend of trade negotiations with the Chinese delegation in Switzerland. It was their first face-to-face meeting since President Trump spiked tariffs on Chinese products. Bessent made a brief statement Sunday with U.S. Trade Representative Ambassador Jameson Greer by his side. The pair touted progress but didn't offer up too many details. Bessent said more info would be announced today.
But I can tell you that the talks were productive. We had the vice premier, two vice ministers who were integrally involved, Ambassador Jameson and myself.
Riveting stuff, Secretary. Riveting stuff. Anyway, Greer told reporters that maybe our differences with China were not as big as they seemed. An interesting take on countries that have so far doled out over 100% tariffs to one another. But Greer appeared to suggest that a deal of some kind was made.
Just remember why we're here in the first place. The United States has a massive $1.2 trillion trade deficit. So the president declared a national emergency and imposed tariffs. And we're confident that the deal we struck with our Chinese partners will help us to work toward resolving that national emergency.
President Trump commented on the negotiation Saturday in a Truth Social post saying, quote, many things discussed, much agreed to. A total reset negotiated in a friendly but constructive manner. What the president meant by a total reset remains to be seen. Also, what many things were discussed. The Chinese delegation called the talks constructive and said it would be issuing a joint statement with the U.S. today. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky on Sunday invited Russian President Vladimir Putin to meet with him face-to-face for direct peace talks in Turkey after a chaotic weekend of back and forth between the two countries. This all started Saturday, when Ukraine, along with other European countries, demanded that Russia agree to an unconditional 30-day ceasefire or face, quote, massive new sanctions. Russia rejected the ceasefire. Instead, Putin proposed that Ukrainian and Russian officials meet directly for peace talks in Turkey on Thursday. Trump called on Ukraine to, quote, immediately accept the proposal in a post on Truth Social Sunday. The president wrote that the meeting would allow European leaders in the U.S. to know if a deal between Russia and Ukraine is actually possible. He added that he's, quote, starting to doubt that Ukraine wants to make a deal. Zelensky responded, saying that he is willing to meet with Putin himself. He tweeted Sunday, quote, there is no point in prolonging the killings, and I will be waiting for Putin in Turkey on Thursday. Personally, I hope that this time the Russians will not look for excuses. As of our recording Sunday night, Putin has yet to respond to Zelensky's offer. Rumeysa Ozturk was released on bail Friday after 6 weeks in a Louisiana immigration detention center. The Turkish doctoral student at Tufts University faces deportation after the White House accused her of engaging in, quote, activities in support of Hamas. Ozturk was arrested by immigration authorities in late March, and her student visa was revoked. Ozturk's lawyers say she was targeted over an op-ed she co-wrote for Tufts student newspaper last year, criticizing the university's response to pro-Palestinian student protests. The federal government has cited this op-ed, an op-ed she co-wrote, in its case against her. She has not been charged with any crime. A federal judge in Vermont said Friday Ozturk's detention was a violation of First Amendment rights and, quote, potentially chills the speech of the millions and millions of individuals in this country who are not citizens. He ordered her immediate release. But her legal battle isn't over. She's still fighting the Trump administration's efforts to deport her. Ozturk spoke at a news conference at Boston Logan International Airport where she thanked her supporters and said she will continue fighting her case in court.
America is the greatest democracy in the world, and I believe in those values that we share. I have faith in the American system of justice.
Meanwhile, White House Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller says that the Trump administration is considering suspending habeas corpus because he does not have faith in the American system of justice. Habeas corpus is a provision in the Constitution that grants people, including non-citizens, the right to challenge their detention in court. Miller spoke to reporters at the White House on Friday.
Well, the Constitution is clear, and that, of course, is the supreme law of the land, that the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus can be suspended in a time of invasion. So I would say that's an option we're actively looking at.
To put things very mildly, this would be really fucking bad. Ostrich challenged her detention with a writ of habeas corpus. Habeas petitions are at the center of many lawsuits against the White House's deportation efforts. And you can't scream invasion because you want to send people to prison and remove their right to know why. Sources told CNN that President Trump has been personally involved in discussions about potentially suspending habeas corpus. But the answer to the age-old question, can he legally do that, is unclear. And that's the news. That's all for today. If you like the show, make sure you subscribe, leave a review, celebrate good examples of righteous pettiness, and tell your friends to listen. And if you're into reading, and not just about how in both Idaho and Utah, the state government banned non-official flags, like the Rainbow Pride flag, from flying at schools and governmental buildings, so the capitals of both states, Boise and Salt Lake City, simply made the Pride flag an official city flag, like me, What A Day is also a nightly newsletter. Check it out and subscribe at cricut.com/subscribe. I'm Jane Costin, and this show appreciates pettiness wielded for the right reason. What A Day is a production of Cricut Media. It's recorded and mixed by Desmond Taylor. Our associate producers are Raven Yamamoto and Emily Four. Our producer is Michelle Aloy. We had production help today from Johanna Case, Joseph Dutra, Greg Walters, and Julia Clare. Our senior producer is Erica Morrison, and our executive producer is Adrian Hill. Our theme music is by Colin Gilliard and Kashaka. Our production staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.